You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the Trump drama show continues, and so does our election crimes bulletin with Greg Pals. He's fresh from a film shoot. Will Native Americans be the next whole group to be once again discriminated against and have their vote taken away? A lot more on that. There was an interesting meeting. You may have missed it. The Biden administration moves to expand U.S. power in Asia with a new NATO-like agreement and military alliance with Japan and South Korea. That's crucial. We're going to have a lot more on that as well. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. A lot going on. 2 days. The election begins in earnest. You've got the Republicans. They're all going to be up there on stage, except for one person, and guess who? There's a lot going on the front lines in terms of the election theft, and a lot was happening in Atlanta. And I want to remind you that it's our own Greg Pallas, the Election Crimes Bulletin, in which for years we've been pointing a finger, and Greg has been leading us to pay attention to what's going on in Atlanta and what this district attorney is capable of doing in the context of the RICO indictment. And, well, Greg, she did it, didn't she?
Okay. Can you hear me now, Dennis?
I can just about hear you. Please speak up. Technological breakdowns are happening. I think it's
can you hear me now, Dennis?
And the rivers coming out of the sky.
Can you hear me now, Dennis? Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear me now, America? Okay.
Yes, I'll speak for America. Yes.
In Los Angeles. So, okay, so there's a heck of a lot going on in Georgia, and as both the stories in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal have reported, the presidential election will come down once again to the state of Georgia. So, So a few things that we ought to know about what's going on. As you know, the latest, if you remember that film 10,000 Mules, which now Donald Trump, I think, talks about in every single one of his speeches, every single one,
yes,
saying that they,
yes,
have the proof, they have the names, they have the proof that the election was stolen in Georgia, that the groups that there were organizations like Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight. They imply that. They show a picture of Stacey Abrams, but they never say her group paid black men, and it was all black men, by the way, according to them, paid $10 each, to drop forged extra mail-in ballots into the ballot boxes. There was a problem with that, which is that they couldn't find a single extra ballot, even though they claimed that there were something like 250,000 extra ballots dropped into those Georgia drop boxes in Atlanta. That is about 70% of the mail-in vote in Atlanta, apparently, was forged. But they couldn't find one. But here's now where it gets fun. The state of Georgia Election Board has demanded that True the Vote give them the names of the insiders that told them that these organizations, which they are demanding that the state's demanding that they name, because they know that this is a felony crime, that they take the names, that they provide the names of the people who have this information that black people were paid $10 each to dump in these ballots. True the Vote has now claimed that these names are confidential, even though they don't claim that they are journalists to maintain confidentiality or that they're a national security or police agency. Or they are witnesses to a crime, and they won't provide the information about the crime. It's as if, Dennis, you watched a bank robbery and said, oh, I know who committed the bank robbery, and the cop said, well, who did it? And you say, well, I'm not going to tell you.
I'm not telling you. I don't have to tell you.
I'm not telling you. Also, I'm fascinated by the fact that supposedly Stacey Abrams, they showed the faces of Stacey Abrams, George Soros, and Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg's especially interesting because he is a Republican that paid these $10 per voter to stuff these ballots. So at I'm wondering why they would pay them $10 to individually stuff in Dropbox ballots into Georgia when all you have to do is, for 59 cents, put a stamp on it and stick it in the mailbox. In fact, I think that they're prepaid in Georgia, so you can dump 200 in a ballot in a mailbox and who would care? So why are they paying these guys to commit a felony crime? And by the way, every single drop box in Georgia has a camera on it so they can identify people. And there's one guy already, Mark Andrews, who remember that they had one guy in this film, as I've talked about, the 10,000 Mules. It would be a joke, except that this could determine our elections. This is the whole base of the Republican claims of massive voter fraud, and Trump's claim in particular. It's cited now in these indictments.
Greg, I want you to underline the point that there's a whole parallel structure as you tell this story in which they're propping up the heroes of Georgia. So it's going to be,
yes,
it's going to be, you know, a whole bunch of disinformation, and then we're going to have the heroes of Georgia. And the current governor,
yes,
will be the next president.
Okay,
close.
So here's the play. Here's one of the big problems we have, because Trump has made these vicious, insane, and racist accusations, because it's all about black men. This guy, Mark Andrews, for example, was accused of going to 28 ballot boxes, and they have the videotape, but they only showed the same videotape over and over. The reason I mentioned his name, turns out he's a high-tech executive in Atlanta, legally putting in the the ballots of his family members, which is, of course, what you can do in every single state in America, and placing their absentee ballots. He's taking legal action against them, too. It may seem crazy, but this is really important. This was the basis of them saying that they had to, that Trump had put in his alternative electors, who never ran as electors, and this is why he's facing these criminal charges. But the basis is supposedly this information found by True the Vote of this ballots, crazy ballot stuffing going on. So, so now who's going to be the heroes? So, because you have the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, who was elected over Stacey Abrams. Remember, in 2018, because he was Secretary of State, he purged over a third of a million voters, most of them legal voters, overwhelmingly black voters, including Martin Luther King's cousin, who he removed from the voter rolls. That's what elected Kemp as governor. Now, he's being the hero, supposedly responding to the idiocy of Trump's claim of illegal elections, saying the Georgia elections were perfect. So does his Secretary of State, whose name is mispronounced as Brad Raffensperger. It's Raffensperger. He is the purge in general of Georgia. Raffensperger, who's been put on MSNBC, who's 60 Minutes, as well as Kemp, as heroes facing down Trump's charges of vote manipulation, yet it is Raffensperger and Kemp who first said that Georgia elections were fixed by the Democrats. Trump, while Trump is citing True the Vote actually was depending on Kemp, the Republican governor, and Raffensperger, the violently partisan Republican Secretary of State. Now, what's going on here? Raffensperger is, for example, said in 2018 that he had absolute proof, like Joe McCarthy, I have a list of over 1,000 double voters, In fact, we tried to get that list. He turned them over to the Attorney General to prosecute, and the papers ran it front page, top of the nightly news in Georgia, you know, thousands of double voters, creating this hysteria. In fact, not one single case was proven. Not one person was charged, let alone convicted, of double voting. So this stuff about Democrats bending the election is coming from those very people at MSNBC and CBS at 60 Minutes saying are the heroes, denying the election deniers. And you are correct. What is the play here? The play is for Brian Kemp in 2 years, when he can no longer run for a third term as governor, to run instead for the U.S. Senate seat now held by John Ossoff. Because so many Democratic sources, New York Times, CBS, MSNBC, are praising Kemp, they're undermining Ossoff's chance of reelection. John Ossoff is one of the great progressive senators that we have. Not very well known in the rest of America, but he's, you know, but important. They will knock him off. So you're going to end up with Democrats basically running Kemp's campaign for him against Ossoff. 2 years later, you can bet Brian Kemp, who's already said he's open to running for president, will be running as the Republican nominee 2 years after.
And just to remind people that you, one of the amazing parts of your film, of the vigilante film, your most recent film, I know you're working on some new stuff now, we're interested in that, but the shows the depth of racism and the history of these people who we're talking about as portrayed as heroes on MSNBC or whatever. So there's some amazing history that we get from your film, Greg. But I want to sort of direct you back to Atlanta with a different set of glasses on. Talk to us about the power and the importance of having a RICO presentation, having a structure in which the district attorney has a lot more freedom to go deeper and to make the connections that need to be made in a conspiracy like this.
Well, yes. So to create RICO, and understand, I used to work with the U.S. Justice Department. I won the biggest RICO civil RICO case in U.S. history against the nuclear industry, but I also worked in Georgia on their special Georgia racketeering. RICO stands for Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It was originally designed to go after the mafia, because you could always get, you know, the little guys. Mr. Big would order a hit, and the hitman would end up going to the electric chair. Well, Mr. Big was saying, I don't know, all I said is, gee, it's too bad that guy is still walking around alive. So they could never get Mr. Big. So they created a law to go after Mr. Big. But I pointed out to the Justice Department that Mr. Big can sometimes, doesn't have to be some, you know, it's like cartoon Italian out of The Godfather, but it could be a corporate Mr. Big. And we went after the Mr. Big in the nuclear industry. Now they're going after Mr. Big, the one who is in the Oval Office, the center of the spider web. Now that requires certain conditions. Number one, you have to have an enterprise. In other words, you have to have a mob. You have to have a mafia. And the enterprise complies, I mean, you might consider them the Keystone Cops Mafia, but it's Giuliani, it's Sidney Powell, it's the Georgia Republican Party, their chair. The state GOP chairman was involved, head of the Republicans in the Georgia legislature. Their main crime, while many crimes are listed, besides having this enterprise, that is this mob where they're working together, they have to be a conspiracy. Now, when we talk about conspiracy, some people, by the way, Dennis, call me a conspiracy nut, but at the Justice Department, I'm a conspiracy expert. What is a conspiracy? It's two or more people who do something in secret, contrive to do something against the law in secret. And that's what you had with Trump. Professor John Eastman of Pomona College, who came up with this crazy, he came up with actually a way that under the 12th Amendment of our Constitution, which is our Constitution is shaky stuff for a democracy, which does allow for the vice president to actually choose slates of electors, and then you got to fight it out. And he is trying to get Pence to pick up the Trump electors in Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, and Michigan, and Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania was the other one too. Pick those electors instead of the ones who actually won and were going to vote in the Electoral College for Joe Biden. But they couldn't get enough Georgians willing to say that Biden won, because after all, some of those people on those lists, you know, have to live with their neighbors, and some of them are in swing districts, and that would create a backlash. So they looked for guys who claimed that they were duly elected electors who were never elected because they never ran. Well, that's a fraud. You're using the mail. So you have to have what are called predicate acts. I hope I'm not getting too legalistic, but you have to understand what's going on here. The predicate acts are they were filling out affidavits saying, I was elected to pick the president of the United States. Now, I have to say, Dennis, if it were you and me saying we were elected to pick out the president of the United States, I might be a little more forgiving. But I don't know these guys. They just claim, hey, I got elected, I picked the president. It might sound comical, but if Pence were more amenable, I think it would have worked. We came very close to a coup d'etat through these characters. That's why, I mean, it may seem like a joke now, but it really, we came very close to what historians call a self-coup, where the sitting president basically refuses to leave office and manipulates himself back into office.
Right. This is the action, by the way. This is what Tribe and that crew are making the point that in saying that Trump is no longer eligible because he demonstrated an action to set aside that determination, you know, that the following the determination of the people, essentially.
Yes, we do have while the Constitution has its problems, we have some fixes in it called the Bill of Rights. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, known as the Equal Protection Clause, has a Part C, rarely used, Part C, which says that if you are an insurrection against the United States, basically, as we saw on January 6th, whose purpose was to stop the peaceful transfer of power. This was created after the Civil War. You can't run for federal office. It's that simple. And in fact, we've had a couple people in Arizona disqualified because they were involved in the January 6th insurrection. Well, I know another guy who was involved in January 6th insurrection. I could describe him to the cops in a lineup. He has orange hair, orange skin. we're laughing, but we really did come close to a self-coup in the United States. And so what Fannie Fani, I should say. I've been mispronouncing her name, and I do apologize. It's Fani Willis. Fani Willis has brilliantly, what I believe, put together a very, very strong case, because she doesn't have to go into the kind of gelatinous yellow mind and brain of Trump, whereas in the case of Jack Smith, he's kind of made himself a difficult case by saying that Trump knew he had lost. And that's a very difficult thing to prove, because you have to go into Donald Trump's mind and say he knew he lost, and therefore by continuing to question the election, he was a committing a fraud on the public. That's kind of hard to do. So Smith might have a tougher case, though he might have a better jury, because he'll be in Washington, D.C. Now, in the case of Fani Willis, there's a new legal maneuver that you should know about. So her case is simpler. All she has to do is prove that they got a bunch of schmucks together to sign their names, say if they've been elected, they weren't elected. Trump personally knew all about this whole scheme. And he doesn't have to know it's illegal. He doesn't have to know that he actually lost. All he has to do is say that he just has to be part of this conspiracy, which he was. And so she has a much easier case. What Trump's lawyers are trying to do now, though, is move the case to federal court. And the reason he's doing that now, Fani Willis, he can't escape Fani, because if he moves down the street in Atlanta into the federal court building, she goes with him as prosecutor. She still remains the prosecutor. Right. And she's a killer in the courtroom. In fact, some people, including in the black community, think she's too much of a killer. She's very quick to put people in prison. But I would not want to be facing her if I was a defendant, believe me. So she will follow him. But what happens is, instead of picking a jury from Fulton right. County, which is 73% Democratic, she will be right. that the jury will be pulled from six, seven Atlanta counties, and that will be the federal jury pool, which will probably make it about 50-50 Democratic Republican. And remember, it's a criminal trial, Dennis. That means one single Trumpster on that jury can say, I don't care, Trump's my man, I'm not voting him guilty no right. matter what, and he walks. So that's why he wants to move it to federal court. That's the latest
yeah,
on that
and
one.
That, yeah. And I don't know if I'm the only person in the world that remembers the fact that the Rodney King beating jury situation, the move made all the difference in terms of the sentencing. Am I remembering that right?
That is correct. I mean, so your venue is very important. I mean, if you go from a basically Fulton County to the heart of Atlanta, it's going to be a black jury. It's going to be a Democratic jury, and it's going to be an urban jury. That is, you know, it's Atlanta is kind of the San Francisco for the LGBTQ community in the South outside of New Orleans. It's, progressives. It's a big Asian American community. Basically people who are kind of like are kind of partial to democracy and may not look kindly on an attempt to overthrow our government. If you go out to those collar areas in Cobb County, for those who've seen my film Vigilante, there's a woman in red at the beginning of the film who's personally challenged the right of 36,000 voters to vote, most of them black people in her. She's in Cobb County. She would be in that jury.
She never met
any of them. She just got this from this group, True the Vote. She got a bunch of names from them, and she just challenged black voters. There you go. That woman will now be in the jury pool if they can move it to, and people like her, if they can move it to the federal court. That's the big problem for Fani Willis, because Trump's lawyers, I have no doubt, if they're smart and they seem to be smart, they're certainly smart enough to ask for all their fees in advance.
They're doing quite well, given his situation.
Yes. So, he's definitely an ATM for lawyers. Assuming they're smart, and they are, they will try to find one juror that they can convince to stand to just say, absolutely no, I don't care. It's kind of what they call the posse comitatus theory, that if you think a law is unjust or a prosecution's political, you can say innocent no matter what the judge says or what the law says. And that's right. What they will be promoting. It's a very serious. So that little subtle thing, I've been giving you these technical legal details, but these are the things that make cases that put people in jail or let them get home free.
That's why I really wanted to talk to you, even though it seems like some of the old terrain we've gone over, this context is everything. And Greg, we're running out of time, and I do want to spend a few minutes having you talk about what you're working on now. You've been in Oklahoma, you've been on this beat about voter suppression and the electronic Jim Crow for ever now. So what's going on? What are you doing these days?
Well, what we're seeing now, I was actually just in Oklahoma for producer George DiCaprio. As you know, Leonardo DiCaprio is about to release a film about the theft of oil from the Osage Native tribe in Oklahoma, and it's a story from the book it's called Killers of the Flower Moon, based on that book, but it ends in 1923. The Osage were the richest people in the United States and maybe in the world, the richest ethnic group, because they had discovered oil. Well, guess what? They took it away from them. How'd they do it? They put bullets in their head. They literally assigned a guardian. They called every native incompetent. Every Osage was called incompetent. They needed guardians. They assigned them guardians. Their guardians shot them, poisoned them, cyanide, dynamited one's house, etc. And they made themselves the beneficiaries of their estate. So they would become a guardian to an Osage, literally kill them, sometimes marry them and shoot them so they could make sure that they got the money. Now, but that ended 100 years ago. So DiCaprio's family is very concerned, as was I, that it would be seen, and so were the chief standing bear of the Osage, that it would be seen as something that's long past, stealing oil and poisoning indigenous people. Well, it's kind of continued on for the next 100 years, and at the center of it, I don't want to give away too much, but the center of theft is our couple brothers named Koch. And at the center, and this is literally an investigation at the Osage Reservation that I've been on for over 30 years. And we're going to bust this whole story out. I started this investigation with a journalist named Bob Perry, one of our great journalists of all times.
Yeah.
And we're going to be now telling his story in film. We're bringing it out. And this is important because as you do this, and here's the other thing about it, Dennis. You can't steal someone's oil unless you either take their life or take their vote or both. The poisonings continue, but not in the same way. They don't use cyanide. They simply have been dumping we'll talk about that, the oil into the right into the drinking supply. The other, though, is the vote and the fight for the right to vote. And I would like, you know, people listening to this, we know about the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, and the amendments giving African Americans the right to vote after the Civil War. But the American indigenous nations were not given the vote until 1924. And they're still fighting for it. And as I mentioned, that I'm, if you missed it before, like one of the things that the Osage were telling me is that they had to go, they flew out to Arizona to help the Yaqui Pascua Nation, this big reservation in Arizona, where they where the state Republican legislature removed the voting, the polling station. Now, I didn't say that they removed some polling stations. There is none for the entire reservation. These are the games that they're playing. I have never, Dennis, seen. I've talked about the suppression of black vote, but suppression of native vote, it's the worst. Absolutely.
And forgive me for making this point again and again and again. And it comes in the context, for the first time in a long time, that Indigenous communities, Native American communities, are doing serious organizing around the vote and really making a difference. It used to be a little bit different, but there's a lot of activism. And that's got folks nervous. Wouldn't you say, Greg?
Oh, indeed, yes, because the Osage have now restored some of the income that was lost to them, mainly through casinos, mainly through casinos and other ways to take care of the resources. They're trying to move, by the way, to geothermal. They don't want to be digging out oil. They would like to be doing renewable energy, but they're not allowed to by the BIA. So, but they've been taking their resources and helping so many other indigenous groups and tribes around the country protect their votes, including a big push in Nevada. So Arizona and Nevada, the groups that have the resource and the experience, like the Osage, are now coordinating. And the only reason Joe Biden won is because while they shut down polling stations on the reservations all over Arizona and all over Nevada, they went in and did this massive mail-in registration voting campaign. And that's what really put Biden over the top. If it weren't for that shock Native, just this explosion in the Native American vote, Biden would not be president.
See, this is profound, Greg, and this is the kind of work that we're glad that we can share with you and keep a focus on the power of the vote and why there is so much attention across this country in the face of the criminality because of Trump's criminality. It's like a bait and switch situation. Trump does one thing, but what's really happening is about suppressing the vote, and as you call it, the 21st century electronic Jim Crow, and there are all kinds of new ways to doing it. So we're glad that you we have you along, Greg, on this ride, which seems like it's only going to keep getting a little bit more interesting. And of course, we didn't even mention that the violence that we warned folks about, that we've been talking about from the get-go, about what's going to happen when push comes to shove. Well, we've certainly seen plenty of that violence, and it ain't over. When you say that's another big unknown, it just takes a couple of jerks in the wrong spot.
Well, there's a systematic intimidation program going on, including armed men who are standing next to voting boxes in Hispanic communities in Arizona. We are, and I'm about to go to Texas on an investigation of this violence. So it's, unfortunately, it used to be random. Now the intimidation and violence factor are becoming systematic, planned, and nationwide. This is new, by the way. Coming, this is a new business, and I'm very concerned. So we're sending the Palace investigative team to Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and back to Georgia, and you know, wherever else it starts blowing up. But it's, there is no shame here, and one of the problems is by saying that only Trump is the center of this vote stealing conspiracy, we're actually leaving out the really dangerous players, because Trump's frankly has acted pretty much like a clown. And so I'm less worried about a guy who doesn't know what he's doing. I'm very worried about Kemp, Raffensperger, Governor Abbott of Texas, Carrie Lake and her gang in Arizona. These people know what they're doing, and they are challenging.
They're in my post office. Their pictures are on the wall in my post office. We're going to have to leave it right there for now. Greg Palast, Election Crimes Bulletin, 20 years and counting. We appreciate the incredibly good work, Greg. Stay safe, and of course, we're going to be back to you soon.
You got me.
GregPalast.com, by the way. GregPalast.com. Check it out. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk about a Well, a little meeting that happened in Washington, D.C. between our president and a few other global leaders that could really impact the nature of peace in Asia. Stay with us. Van Hunt, Out of the Sky on Flashpoint Pacifica Radio. We're doing investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. Happy to have you along as we broadcast tonight from the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, there's been a lot going on. You may have missed the fact that our U.S. president, that's Joseph Biden, met with his counterpart in South Korea and the Japanese prime minister. This was a major state visit that took place last Friday. And this visit had a very specific focus that could really change the nature of war and peace and lead us to a much down a path that is much closer to the kinds of wars we don't even want to think about. Joining us to talk about this and following it very closely for many years is Tim Sharak. He grew up in Japan, in South Korea. He's the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of the Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence, and is currently working on DMZ Empire. That would be his second book. Well, Tim Sharak, you are the right person to talk about an issue that's not got much attention. It seems like it doesn't even exist in the sort of stenographer style of reporting we see coming out of the corporate media. But tell us about, say a little bit about the nature of this meeting and what is the dream of the United States, the new trilateral alliance, you know, sort of the Asian NATO, I guess you have to think of it as.
Well, first of all, good evening from Washington, D.C., and I appreciate being on your show again. First of all, you know, what Biden is saying this meeting is about and what it's actually about is quite different. And, you know, the Biden and his media lapdogs that repeat everything but the Biden administration says about Japan or Korea are reporting this as a new development that's come about because, you know, South Korea and Japan have decided that the threat from China is so real and so dangerous that they need to, you know, drop their past animosities and create this great alliance with the United States. When in actuality, as we'll talk about a little bit later, the U.S. has been trying to build a trilateral alliance between South Korea and Japan since really the end of World War II and when the United States occupied both Japan and Southern Korea with its military forces. So that said, you know, what they agreed to was, you know, quite significant. They stopped short of a formal alliance, but it's an alliance in all but name between these three countries. The United States, of course, which has a massive string of bases and over 100,000 soldiers in both in Japan and South Korea and Okinawa. And, you know, South Korea, which hosts U.S. forces and has a U.S. general that commands Korean forces during times of war. And Japan, which under its Liberal Democratic Party leadership of the last 20 years has been relentlessly pushing to become a stronger military power and reject its post-World War II peace constitution and become an actual military power. And bringing these three together is very significant. And what they agreed to was, you know, to create a trilateral, what they call a partnership. And they Biden and, you know, Blinken and all his people are, you know, use this occasion to praise what they call the courageous leadership of President Yoon of South Korea and Prime Minister Kishida of Japan in what they call transforming relations. What this leadership consisted of was, one, the U.S. has been hoping that, has been wanting Japan to increase its military budget and develop an offensive capability as a military. And under Kishida, it has done that. Under Kishida, in the last 6 months, actually 6 to 8 months, late last year, the Japanese government passed a law giving Japanese military forces an offensive capability, an ability to attack enemy bases for the first time since World War II. And they've agreed to massively increase their military budget. So that's one. Second, President Yoon, who's a very right-wing conservative militarist, former prosecutor who won the presidency by a very close margin, he went to Japan in March and signed an agreement with Kishida over Korean claims that Japanese corporations exploited Koreans for forced labor during World War II. This has been a long-standing dispute between Japan and South Korea. The way Yoon settled this was they ended the dispute. However, Japan, as a country, and Japanese corporations, and Japan as a company that, you know, employed, you know, forced these people into labor, does not pay anything. Korea pays all the damages. Korea pays all the reparations. The country that suffered from the imperial thrust of Japan pays for its slave labor, pays the penalty, you know. And so it's for a lot of Koreans, it was a very lopsided agreement and really was a sellout to Japan interests. But this is what Biden and Blinken think is really great diplomacy. And what they agreed to was to deepen their military alliance, to have regular trilateral, you know, three-country military exercises, and they have this word that was a key word that came out of it called duty to inform, which if there's a threat to one of them, the other countries have to, you know, inform the others, and it means basically that any one of the countries would be automatically involved if there's attack on either one. And what I see that is as an opening for, at some point, if there is another Korean War, if there's a Korean collapse in North Korea, the U.S. has always wanted to kind of be able to use Japanese forces in that situation. And I think this could actually bring Japanese forces to Korea for the first time since World War II. You know, so if there was a war, of course. But, I mean, that's the significance of this. But, you know, it was hardly any attention was paid to it by the media except for, the New York Times and the Washington Post ran their typical articles, you know, explaining it from the administration.
And it is really cynical and troubling that the United States really seized the change in administration in South Korea, where in the prior leader, the prior president in Moon, there was somebody who really wanted reunification, wanted a different kind of agreement and arrangement and transformation, and it's a whole different vision. And here comes the United States, Moon disappears, and it's like full blast towards the new NATO. I mean, that's what I'm referring to. I mean, that's when they say one for all for one. I mean, here we go again.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what I mean, the U.S., like I said, the U.S. has been pushing this for years and years and years because it's...
It's part of the pivot, right? It's part of what's known as the pivot. The United States decided that they will control Asia, China, the China century by land, air, sea, and space. That's the decision, right? That's U.S. long-term policy.
That was started under President Obama, and Obama's key person on Asia at the time was a guy named Kurt Campbell, who is now Biden's Asia czar, so-called, and he was the one who came up with the whole idea of the Asia pivot, the Pacific pivot, and that's exactly right. It's this, you know, this move of, you know, U.S. forces from the Middle East to Asia, but this is a lot more than that. I mean, you know, what this is, you know, in, you know, and the second thing is what you just said, is that the U.S. has always been siding with the most right-wing elements, the South Korean leaders that are right-wing. It always dislikes progressives that are elected, going way back to Kim Dae-jung, who was a dissident hero. The U.S. always considered him some kind of leftist, secret, you know, communist, or, you know, somebody not to be trusted. They only work closely with these close, you know, right-wing militarists. And, you know, Moon Jae-in, you know, like a lot of Koreans, wanted to have a peaceful settlement to the Korean War and end the hostilities. And he had, his policy was engagement with North Korea. And that's something that Biden really dismissed in part because, you know, Trump, of course, President Trump followed Moon's lead and engaged with North Korea, and at, you know, South Korean suggestion, met with Kim Jong-un, and they, you know, they had some meetings, and they came fairly close to a major agreement that could have delivered a peace process to Korea. But, you know, Trump wouldn't sign it because, you know, he was advised by John Bolton and you know, hardliners like that, you know, not to do it. It wasn't in U.S. interest. So he walked away. And since that collapse, tensions between North and South have been very high. But the thing is, in the past, you had right-wing militarist leaders in South Korea, but they never were this pro-Japanese. I mean, Park Chung-hee, who introduced, you know, the normalized relations, was, of course, trained by the Japanese army, and the South Korean army that was created in the 40s and 50s was mostly Koreans who had served with the Japanese Empire during the colonial period in World War II. But, like, you know, this agreement that Yoon signed, where Japan bears no responsibility, pays no reparations, to me is so one-sided, and to think that our leaders would praise that and think it's a great act of diplomacy is beyond me. But, you know, the one true thing that was said by Jake Sullivan, who briefed reporters beforehand, was, you know, he talked about this has been in the works for decades. Basically, he talked about 150 years of alliance cooperation with Japan and Korea. We're now stitching all that work together to enhance regional stability and security. That's what he said. And he's right. You go back 75 years, and 75 years ago, the U.S. was encouraging, wanted Japan to come back to South Korea. And then, you know, during the Cold War and during the period when Park Chung-hee was in power, they really came up with this idea of bringing the three countries into a more trilateral relationship. And they've been pushing it ever since.
So I guess we can assume, with these new concepts and this new union, NATO-like union, that we will maybe see expanded. I mean, we've seen some pretty large and out-of-control U.S. military exercises, and it's, you know, it's legendary U.S. training so-called operations in South Korea. But I guess we can see now with Japan in the middle there, somehow they got over things like the comfort women to work together on this militarization. But this could be, this could mean much more threatening exercises and military operations, say, to China and what China is up to in the region, where they happen to live.
Well, they've already held trilateral exercises, and they're going to continue doing them. And that, you know, the North Koreans warned today that when they do this, they bring in what they call, you know, strategic weapons. They bring in nuclear weapons into the war zone there. And you know, like a month ago, the U.S. nuclear submarine called in a South Korean port, you know, first time for many years since 1980s, you know, openly calling it at a Korean port. And so they're, you know, well, they're demanding that North Korea denuclearize. They're, you know, using their nuclear weapons in these, bringing these nuclear weapons and nuclear armed planes and ships, you know, in using these for these military exercises where they obviously practice nuclear war. I mean, that's what you practice, you know. So when you practice these war games that they don't play, they're not games. They're you know, they're outlined for how to conduct a war. And in the past, the U.S. and South Korea have practiced, you know, regime change in North Korea. They call it leadership decapitation, where they go in and assassinate leaders. And of course, you know, these kinds of things are seen as kind of belligerent and threatening. And so North Korea, you know, raises its ante by, you know, showing it can have missiles that can hit U.S. bases all over Japan and Korea and Okinawa. So, you know, that they keep shooting these missiles, and the U.S. keeps saying, you know, they shouldn't do that. It shows how they're escalating, and then we escalate. So, I mean, it's really kind of become out of control now. And the thing is, like in the past, it was always, you know, the U.S. and South Korea versus North Korea, with Japan as kind of an observer. Now Japan will be in the middle of it because of these agreements they've made. And, you know, Japan was a colonial power for 35 years. Japan was, you know, part of the reason that Korea was divided, because Japan effectively divided South Korean society into Japanese collaborators and those that didn't. Unfortunately, and the governments that the United States helped form in the late 40s and 50s were formed mostly by people that collaborated with the Japanese. That began to change as, you know, Korea became a democratic country. But, you know, a lot of these conservative leaders themselves have ties to Japan. Yoon does through his own father, was educated in Japan. And he's seen as very pro-Japanese. And, of course, you know, the Americans really love the fact that Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, which has been basically in power since 1955, if you can imagine that, they love the fact that they've, you know, adopted these new sort of aggressive military policies where they'll be able to attack an enemy base in, say, China or North Korea or anywhere where the U.S. decides that there's going to be a war, or where they all three, decide there's going to be a war. But to have Japanese forces possibly involved in the Korean Peninsula, to me, is just a really dangerous thing. And I know that there are South Koreans who would, if it came to Japanese forces in Korea, they would fight the Japanese forces rather than their own people in the north. So I think it stupidly complicates things in South Korea.
In terms of the expansionism, we now see under the new addition of Marcos in the Philippines, strong and expanding U.S. military and strategic support. The Philippines has always been a jumping off point for the United States into Asia. Is that something that should be watched?
Well, yeah. I mean, that the U.S. is, increasing its militarization everywhere. I mean, it has these new base agreements with the Philippines. And, you know, it's always trying to strike new deals in different parts of Southeast Asia. So, yeah, it's part of the same, you know, continuum.
So we just have a couple of minutes left. What are a couple of your major concerns in terms of this new policy, this new arrangement, NATO-like arrangement between Japan, South Korea, and the United States?
Well, my main concern is that it could dangerously involve Japanese forces being, first of all, you know, many Japanese still want to keep their peace constitution. That is not an issue that's been settled. The conservatives there would like to get rid of it, and they've been trying to get rid of it for years. But like most of the public in Japan supports it. So to me, that's one of the most dangerous things, is giving Japan, you know, making Japan into a military power, but completely, you know, under the rule of the United States. And South Korea is in the same position. So it basically, it's going to expand the U.S. military force by combining the three militaries in cooperative arrangements, which is already going on. And I mean, they share, you know, missile defense systems, other military systems. But that, you know, with this trilateral arrangement, there'll be other military systems that'll be, you know, and it'll be all three countries. And so that in itself is a big deal for military contractors, you know. For example, you know, missile defense, they all have the same ships in common, Aegis-class destroyers that carry, you know, that are part of the missile defense system, right? And so, you know, they're made by Lockheed Martin. So it's to have a bigger market for these ships, that's really great for companies like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. And I think it's an increase in militarization of the whole area. When, you know, Korea, you know, in 2019, we were on the verge of having an agreement that could have ended the Korean War, that could have at least really de-escalated the tensions there. And there could have been a way that South and North Korea would have been working together if that agreement had come to fruition, but it didn't. And after Obama came in, the U.S. began, you know, just said, okay, we'll only talk to North Korea about denuclearization, but we're going to continue and expand our military might and our military confrontation to prevent North Korea from expanding its nuclear arsenal or expanding its missiles. It's a military confrontational policy instead of engagement and trying to negotiate an end to the conflict. That's what concerns me.
There was never any formal signing of a peace treaty that ended that war.
Well, there was an armistice, and the armistice temporarily stopped the fighting for 70 years now. And they've just, you know, been celebrating the 70-year anniversary of the armistice and also the U.S.-South Korean military alliance. And, you know, when I wrote an article on my website in July about the 70th anniversary, I said the U.S. is part of this anniversary. The U.S. is, instead of making peace, the U.S. is introducing a new trilateral alliance that could keep U.S. troops in Asia forever. And I noticed in the New York Times summary the other day of what Biden and the three leaders agreed to, they said they're going to hold trilateral meetings to deepen their alliance and to deepen their military alliance and expand these exercises. And Biden said, not just this year, not just next year, but forever. So they're talking long-term.
Yeah. Oh, God, I heard that. I got a chill. I got it. We're out of time. I'm so sorry to interrupt. Amazing information, incredibly important, not reported, this historical context counteracts what we refer to as stenographer journalism. Your work is great. We're out of time. I hope you'll come back and continue to talk with us about this crucial situation.
TimSherrock.com. That's where you can find my work. And I really appreciate it, Dennis. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you are so welcome, and you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's it for us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. They have feelings, they have personalities. And now I'm knee-deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat on the next Voices for the Animals, airing Friday, August 25th at 10 a.m. right here on 90.7 KBOO FM.